the only preparation better for diplomacy than being Irish is to be Scots-Irish. Our guest today was born in Glasgow, of Irish nationality, studied economics at the University College Dublin, entered the public service in 1944 and the Irish diplomatic service in 1949, served then as vice consul in Boston and New York, returned to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Dublin, then first secretary in the Irish Embassy in Brussels, and then in Paris, then returned to Dublin. He became Deputy Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Dublin, joined the Commission of the European Communities in Brussels as Deputy Director for External Relations, then Director General for Fisheries, and then on March the 1st of this current year, Ambassador and Head of Delegation to the United Nations in New York. We have been discussing governance within a domestic context. Nothing could be more relevant than to draw us into the discussions and the scene of governance within the emerging European communities. And so it's a great honor to have Ambassador Gallagher with us, and we look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Good morning. I don't know how people can come out this early in the day to listen to anybody on any subject, but it's your choice, and I hope it will be all right. This is not all speech or anything. Don't think that I'm going to read a great volume. But I think I do need to put the thing into some kind of framework so that we can discuss it in more detail. And as is the custom in the European communities, for good reasons, we take always a pragmatic and a practical approach. We come from that direction to solving problems, and not from first principles. And this, of course, is in contradiction with the approach to constitution making in the American Age of the Enlightenment. And to say we approach constitution making in Europe pragmatically, especially on the grounds of Mr. Jefferson University, is practically lèse majesté. But what else can I do? That is the difference. So I have to have good reasons for that kind of misconduct. And the principal reason is that in Western Europe, we're integrating, politically and economically, a number of countries whose roots are very, very deep in history, whose histories are extremely different from each other. Some were empires, and some were the victims of empires. Between them, they've probably fought more wars than any other similar size of the world. They've been at it since time began, and they've only stopped doing it in quite recent years. But now they have finally renounced war, at least among themselves, as any kind of answer to their rivalries. In fact, at the origin of the European Community Treaties is that decision, the decision to make war between themselves impossible. Now, on such a foundation, which really is layers upon layers of history, from the painted caves of France, for example, going back to prehistoric times, and what has just been discovered literally in the last few months in the west of Ireland, villages dating from 5,000 years ago. We didn't even know they existed until this year. And through all the migrations since then, back and forth across Europe, creating bit by bit the human landscape that we now have to deal with, we just did not, on that kind of foundation, have the luxury of bringing forth something pristine, something new, as America had 200 years ago. Instead, we are trying to bring forth something unique. And what we have is a process. It's not a finality, it's a process. The process began more than 30 years ago with the negotiation of the Treaty of Paris, the forgotten treaty, the Treaty of Paris. This treaty was the treaty which created Euratom, which nobody has heard of for 30 years. And although it's 230 articles long, which is almost as long as the Treaty of Rome, which is 240 articles long, practically every single word of all those articles is a dead letter. Maybe this is because Euratom dealt with atomic energy. And atomic energy is far too close to military uses. Certainly was 30 years ago, perhaps even is today. And when you get that close to sovereignty, people start pulling back. And Euratom, which was created in a frenzy of interest and excitement at that time to control the peaceful uses of atomic energy, never actually got underway, never happened. At about the same time, or rather before that, slightly before that, we had created the Coal and Steel Community. The Coal and Steel Community was what it says it was. It actually dealt with coal and steel. And that idea was simply that if you could get a control of those industries, then you control the sinews of war automatically. No one could start a war without controlling his own steel production. No one could have a steel production without actually controlling his own source of energy, which was coal. So that the first stage in the creation of this notion of ending war in Europe was in fact to amalgamate, for all practical purposes, the coal and steel industries of Germany and France. And this has worked extremely well. It was the first real foundation of what we now call the European communities. It has worked so well, in fact, that we no longer have a coal industry. That's how good it is. And as for steel, we've had nothing but trouble with the United States for the last 30 years about your steel industry, which, if anything, is even more incompetent than ours. But so long as you can keep things on that basis, we haven't got time to start fighting each other. And that in itself has an attraction. Now, the odd thing about the coal and steel community was the United Kingdom was not a member of it, but did actually have a relationship with it, which nearly always seems to be the case of the United Kingdom in dealing with Europe. Never really quite a member, but always there or thereabouts, and getting a little bit closer perhaps all the time. Even just today, the United Kingdom has joined, finally, the exchange rate mechanism. It's taken 8 years to persuade Mrs. Thatcher of the value of doing that. So that at the very beginning, the United Kingdom was there, but not really in it. That's just a matter of curiosity. En passant. The main treaty, of course, is the Treaty of Rome. This created the European Economic Community, which is what it was then called. And the Treaty of Rome can be said to cover either in actuality or in potentiality, all economic activity. And that's its intention. Its intention is to be able to cover them all, not necessarily exercising competence immediately, but exercising competences and increasing competences gradually. Now, the first few years of the Treaty of Rome were very successful. The six original member states brought forward time and again the deadlines for dealing with tariff cutting and tariff elimination, so that they reached, in effect, a tariff-free zone within far fewer years than had been allowed for. This itself gave an elan to the treaty in the initial years. It actually worked and worked very well. They also, in those years, created the Common Agricultural Policy. I'm sure you've heard about the Common Agricultural Policy. When it comes to any kind of row between the community and the United States, it always comes down to agriculture. And the cause of that is your agriculture and our agriculture, what we call the Common Agricultural Policy. This had a historic meaning, which we can't walk away from. It was the price that Germany paid to France for having the economic community in the first instance. France had to have a gain on the agricultural side against opening up its industrial markets to Germany, which is the great industrial power, not only of the future in Europe, but of today in Europe. So the CAP, it's called that for short, actually has a historic resonance that can't be ignored even by CAP negotiators. There was also the promise contained in the preamble to the Treaty of Rome that the other peoples of Europe who shared their ideals, meaning by that countries which were democratically governed, could join in the efforts of the original six. They had a right to join. And the original six had denied themselves the right to refuse. That promise in the preamble has been kept three times. First of all, by the admission of three member states in 1973, United Kingdom, Ireland, Denmark. Norway was also accepted at that time, but Norway chose to opt out and not to ratify the treaty. It was kept a second time when Greece joined the community in 1981. And it was kept a third time, that promise, when Spain and Portugal joined the community in 1985. And what's fascinating about those things, in a way, especially of the last two, Spain and Portugal, both of those countries wanted to join the community in order to confirm their own democracies. That was their main reason for doing it. They had both emerged from a long, long period of dictatorship, Franco in one case, Salazar in the other case, and their motivation, their fundamental motivation was to maintain a democratic system, and the best way they saw of doing that was to join the European community. So it's not just economic, it's a highly political community. These were among the successes of the last 25 years or so, but success in its own perverse way breeds its problems. It creates the problems of the present. And one of these problems, in fact, is the increasing number of European countries which have either applied for membership or are about to apply for membership or are very likely to find themselves necessarily applying for membership. And there's an awful lot of them. We already have applications for membership from Austria, from Malta, and from Cyprus. Liechtenstein has just joined the United Nations this year, and I fear in my suspicious mind that this is an attempt to join the European community later on by proving they're a country first. Once you join the UN, you're a country, then you can try all the rest. Liechtenstein has 100,000 people. It's going to be interesting having a Liechtenstein veto. But then the countries which I think will apply soon include the countries of the European Free Trade Area Association. At the minute we're conducting negotiations with EFTA, as we call it, for what we call a European Economic Space or a European Economic Area. And I hesitate to say what the idea behind that is because I'm not quite sure. There are those foul-minded people who say the European community thought this up to keep EFTA countries out of the community by saying we'll create an economic space, you fit into that and you'll be very happy. And now don't bother us with applications for membership. And I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't some truth in that. But in my view, it's not going to work, because we are being asked to square the circle here with the after countries, who say, understandably, if we're going to accept all your rules, basically, with whatever exceptions we can negotiate, and if you then change the rules without consulting us, then of course we are rather badly stuck. So there must be some provision under which we are involved in your future decision-making process. Understandable. Also unacceptable. Because the answer to that simply is, well, if that's what you want, then join. I mean, you can't expect to be in the Rules Committee and not join the club and not pay the full cost of joining the club. And frankly, I don't see circle is going to be squared. I don't think it can be done. Therefore, I think that even if we find some form of words that gets over that problem in the short term, that they'll be so meaningless in practice that the EFTA countries, for the most part, will apply for membership of the European Community within, say, 3-4 years at the outside. And they are Sweden, Norway, Austria has applied already. Question of Finland, will Finland move in that direction or not? Finland has a particular relationship with the Soviet Union. How long will the Soviet Union last in its present form? Which is a serious question. So that too is an issue. Iceland is a European country in the middle of the Atlantic, which wants to maintain independence in every sense, but lives in an interdependent world like everybody else, and may have to yield to that particular necessity. So I can see 3-4 of those states applying for membership in the near future. Then on top of that, you've got all the East European countries, and I see quite a lot of their representatives in New York, including in the last few days. And they will tell you quite frankly that Hungary, for example, intends to apply to join in 1993. Poland can't understand why the community hasn't already joined Poland. Czechoslovakia is trying to work out whether it's Czech or Slovak, or in fact, as it is, both, a problem. Yugoslavia is falling apart. The Croatian authorities have sent a representative to New York. He's not official, of course, but he's there. And any time anybody looks for somebody to speak for Czechoslovakia, for Yugoslavia, you will get the Croat, whatever it is, Croat, Croatian. He comes and speaks for Croatia and will tell you, well, the rest of Yugoslavia doesn't really matter, which isn't altogether accurate. So these countries are certainly, in their own minds, they say, we are now eligible because we fulfill your ideas. We are a democratic state. You may cavil at that here and there in relation to, say, Bulgaria, to some degree, Romania, and so on. But essentially, they are going in that direction, like it or lump it. And we have to face that issue. So there could possibly, by the end of this decade, there could be as many as 20 to 24 member states of the European communities. And the present structures will not be able to maintain that size of community. I don't want to spend all the time speaking. I'd much rather listen to questions and try to answer them. But I do have to say something in explanation of that, why the present structures will not be able to accommodate 20 or 24 member states and therefore have to be changed. The structures are the European Parliament. This is a parliament with limited powers. In the strict Latin sense of the word, it's irresponsible. What I mean by that is it's not responsible to anybody. It's not responsible to a government. It's not responsible to an administration. And that, by definition, makes the parliament itself irresponsible. It seeks more authority, but does not rush to offer greater accountability to anybody. So you have to worry about that. One of the great debates in the writing of the American Constitution was precisely about the relationship between legislature and executive, on which there's a great volume of marvelous literature. As the European Parliament, when I say this in parentheses, unfortunately, and I end the parenthesis, and I will deny I said that, as it pre-exists the creation of a full and satisfactory European constitution, the risk is that it will try to determine what the constitution should be. And in the process, will confuse demos with hegemony. This is the problem, as I see it. Now, I said we'll confuse demos with hegemony, is what I said. What I mean by that is we'll confuse the notion of democracy with the notion of taking power, which is not the same thing. But one will be used to justify the other, so that you will burden democracy with hegemony and then be unable to operate. And this was one of the greatest arguments at the time of the creation of the American Constitution. And I'll come back to that in a moment, because there's something I want to quote to you which is of remarkable interest. The second institution is the council of the community. The council is the decision maker. It's composed of ministers from each of the member states. It meets in a whole series of formations. When it meets as the Foreign Affairs or General Affairs Council, it's composed of the Ministers for Foreign Affairs. When it meets as an Agricultural Council, it meets at the level of Ministers for Agriculture, and so on. It's crowned, if you can use that word in a Republican country, it's crowned by the European Council, which is composed of the heads of government, or in one case the head of state, because the French president is head of state and head of government. The council meets in private, meets behind closed doors, and insofar as it is effectively the real seat of legislation, much of it very detailed legislation, the privacy of its proceedings is a barrier to full public understanding and therefore to full public acceptance of what it does. This is a real problem in government as well, that if the real seat of power meets behind closed doors, then how can the public be expected to respond to it? Now, it's in relationship to that amalgam, or whatever it is, of the parliament seeking power and the council which has it, that I find myself facing the obligation to quote from Mr. Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia. And these notes were referred to in the Federalist Papers in one of the great articles written by another Virginian, James Madison. And Jefferson said, and I quote, "All the powers of government, legislative, executive, and judiciary, result to the legislative body. The concentrating these in the same hands is precisely the definition of despotic government." It's a marvelous phrase that Jefferson 200 years ago realized the importance of controlling the legislature, of not letting it become itself the despot, if it had all power. And hence, of course, later on, in the American Constitution, the division of power between executive, legislature, and judiciary. And again, in the way of the world, not all these things work perfectly all the time. You still have problems, as we see even these days. But we have that problem today. And I'm not sure that the depth of debate in Europe about that kind of problem is great enough to warn people about the dangers also inherent, as well as the advantages inherent in what we're trying to do. The third body which deals with Europe, or the creation of it, is the Commission, of which I'm a staff member. This is composed of at least one commissioner from each member state, and the larger states have two commissioners, an extra one each, a total of 17 at the present time. The Commission is the sole initiator of legislation, and the Council decides upon the Commission's proposals after any necessary consultation with the Parliament. The Commission is also the executive that administers the legislation as adopted. And then finally, the fourth body is the Court of Justice, which now meets in two chambers, which one of them is partially a chamber of first instance. It has judges from each of the member states and is universally recognised to be a very high standard. It has modelled itself on the US Supreme Court and to some extent has the same teething problems as the US Supreme Court had. That's to say, reliance on somebody else to enforce its decisions. And in America, certainly well into the 1820s, 1830s, and possibly later, yes, indeed later, the Supreme Court had difficulty in having its decisions respected. There is the famous Yazoo Lance case, where I think it was President Jackson said simply, well, John Marshall has made a decision, now let him enforce it. And he refused to enforce that decision. John Marshall, also is a Virginian. Why they all came from Virginia, I don't know. Jefferson, Madison, Marshall. There you are. Now, we have the same problem in Europe of the court decisions not being enforced. Not through defiance, which at least is valuable. It's not through defiance. It's through incompetence. Through... reluctance, yes, but not defiance. We haven't reached that state. I don't think we will. But it is one of the questions now being discussed in relationship to the new Europe. How do we enforce court decisions? There must be some method, and not just leave them in the air. Now, these four things, the Parliament, the Council, the Commission, and the Court of Justice, are the institutions of the community. We have to now see how they can be modified and improved to meet the exigencies of a much bigger and a much more integrated European community of the future. How should the European community of the future be governed is the question. I don't believe, and I've said this already, I repeat it, I do not believe that the public opinion in Europe is fully aware of the importance of this debate or of the depth of the discussion that must take place. We have what can only now be called a European gift for using nine languages to banalize everything we say. Pragmatism in that sense, and here I contradict myself, and here I convict myself, if you like. Pragmatism edges out enlightenment. This is the problem. The debate takes several forms in Europe, which no doubt you've all heard about, read about here and there. It seems to be one day about economic and monetary union, usually written as EMU, MU, on the one hand. And on the other hand, a debate goes on about political union. These are the two words used, MU and political union. For the time being, because of the Gulf crisis, we have left the headlines, but we'll come back to the headlines on these issues in due time because they are important. Monetary and economic union go hand in hand. They are not the same thing, but they impinge so much on each other that by common consent, they are treated together. A European community of 20 or 24 member states living in a single market structure, which will come into effect on the 1st of January 1993, and you can be sure of that, it will actually come into effect. There may be little things left behind here and there, but the majority of it will be in effect on 1 January 1993, and which will be applicable to each new member state as it comes in, because the rules of the game are very simple. If you join the community, you accept its rules on day one. Now, you may get derogations in terms of time to accommodate yourself to a rule here and there, but there's no getting away from your acceptance of the rules on the first day. Therefore, the single market applies to each new member state on day one of their entry to Europe, with whatever temporary derogations there might be. Now, a community of that size, with a single market, with up to 24 different economic policies, and up to 24 different currencies, cannot exist. It is simply practically impossible to run a single market with 24 currencies. It's estimated that in the present community of 12 member states, that the use of 12 currencies is costing trade about $27 billion per annum in wasted money. And it goes to the banks, and we will all shed a tear over the loss to the banks. But having done that, we really do have to live with much less absurdity than that. And in a community of 20 to 24 member states, that kind of thing simply isn't on. Now, the debate has been going on this MU for some time. And it's interesting to note that the governors of the central banks of the 12 have reached virtual finality of a treaty on monetary union. All that's left undecided among the 12 central bankers is the question of timing and the phasing in of the various aspects of it. There is no major political question between the 12 central bankers. Of course, they're working on the basis that their political masters may not accept this. But as a technical exercise, it has been virtually completed already and can be finalized in very short order. And one member state, the United Kingdom, is not committed to the principle of economic and monetary union. And in fairness to the British Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher, she has clearly understood that MU is not simply a technical operation. It does touch upon central areas of national sovereignty, no doubt about that. And her contribution to the debate precisely is in raising this point. It would be foolish in the extreme, and I think on the whole, very unhelpful to a future European community, if we proceeded blithely to an extraordinary step forward in economic and monetary integration as if it were simply technical, and then find out later the political cost. I think that would be very dangerous. I think equally that it's also foolish to believe that the tide advancing in this direction can be stopped by any one state or by any one prime minister. The tide is far too heavy. The need is far too great. Therefore, in my view, EMU will happen and will or will not incorporate the United Kingdom. That's a decision for the United Kingdom to make in due time. Now, in talking about European unity, you may have noticed that, and I think it was right in this particular place, in Mr. Jefferson University, I have not used the words federation or confederation. They have different emotive concepts, depending on where you are and at what time. The issue in Europe is not federation, is not confederation. It is shared sovereignty. And how you put that down later is a matter, I think, of no great importance at all. What word you use later on doesn't really matter. But if Maggie Thatcher has made a major contribution to Europe, it is in that she has done it, that she has said, in her own abrasive way, be it said, this is about sovereignty. It's not about money or technicalities. The fact that she says, here another parenthesis, that it's about the sovereignty of Parliament is, of course, a joke. The British Parliament has no more sovereignty than the town council of Charlottesville. The British government controls the sovereignty of the United Kingdom, not the Parliament. So that when Mrs. Thatcher, in her own delightful fashion, talks about protecting the sovereignty of Parliament, all I can do is either laugh or cry, depending on my mood, because it isn't true. Now, the second aspect of the debate is the debate about political union, about which we hear an awful lot less. It's partly because nobody knows yet what it means. It can be about fundamental things. It can be. It can be about things like a common foreign policy. It can be about a security policy, which includes defence, about common citizenship, and so on. It can also be about the relationship between the four institutions, Parliament, Council, Commission, Court of Justice, about democratic legitimacy. It can be about the links between power and the people, which is the problem always. It can be about accountability, political accountability. All the things that you will find in the Federalist Papers 200 years ago, they're all there. Not one of them is left out. That's the extraordinary thing about those papers, that all you have to do is look up the index under any of these words, and you will find a Federalist paper, whether it's number 48 or 82 or whatever it is. And it's extraordinary. And in fact, I've enjoyed enormously reading the Federalist Papers again in the last few days, just to confirm to myself that what we're trying to do in Europe today was done in America 200 years ago. And I don't think most of us are conscious of that in Europe. Perhaps I should make my speeches over there. Now, finally, the Gulf crisis has come as a very timely warning to us in Europe about where we're going, what we're doing, what we are. People have complained, principally in the United States, but not only in the US, that the European community did not respond adequately to the Gulf crisis. Sometimes people think this inadequacy is about substance. Sometimes people say, no, it's because it took you too long to decide what to do. My view is that neither of these things is itself sufficient. I think it's about the imperfections of the European community's present powers, its present institutions, and especially of its decision-making procedures, which are between 30 years old up to the present day. Even before the Gulf crisis began, it only began after all on the 2nd of August, we had begun to speculate about these inadequacies ourselves in Europe, about our lack of economic and monetary union, about our weaknesses on the political side of union, so that our speculation on these things does precede the Gulf crisis. And what's important about the Gulf crisis, in a sense, is that it will force us to dig much more deeply into what we're trying to do, into understanding what our future should be. Now, what we are groping forward to is something that doesn't exist. As I say, I don't know what it is. It's not a federation, it's not a confederation, it's something we don't know. The structure probably will never be final. Our method is debate. It's not Napoleonic, it's debate. Usually reasonably quiet, perhaps too quiet, debate, but sometimes fairly raucous. I'm quite sure that at the end of all that, we will not produce a blueprint as elegant as the American Constitution, together with the Bill of Rights. That was an original, which will never be emulated, in my view. But as I said earlier, and now repeat as my final word, you've been very patient with me so far. Thanks very much indeed for that. But as my final word in this contribution to our discussion, our result will not be like anything the mind of man has so far conceived in order to canalize, to protect, and to pursue his reasonable interest. Given the number of committees we have working on this, the end result may look like a camel, but it will be a singular, unique camel. And most importantly, it will be our own, our very own camel, however ugly it looks. Now, I did mention Mrs. Thatcher once or twice with admiration, but let me, in finishing, quote her Deputy Prime Minister, Sir Geoffrey Hart. He said this less than 4 weeks ago, much to my amusement, be it said. And I quote him, bearing in mind all the things that his boss had been saying. "The nation state," he said, "is not the final resting place of European constitutional development," unquote. And there I can rest my case. And thank you very much.
Two points. First, the council is a mishmash of maybe, or amalgam of maybe 50 to 60 people. No stability because a membership changes as minister changes in when the constituent governments or depending on the subject being discussed. Whereas the parliament, with its members designated by the various member states, could be made into a relatively stable group out in the public, and if its powers could be increased, it might be a better unit around which to build a government. Now, but as to this, the second point, as to the proliferation of the member states, might it not be possible to, say, work on the framework of the Council of Europe and beef it up in some meaningful way and, in effect, have the 10 or 12 people, states not in the Confederation or in the ECU unit now, as in effect junior members with a relationship between the core and the junior group gradually working over a period of years. It would give a basis for a working arrangement rather than having the whole concentration on the community all at once when the structure isn't able to handle it. Those are two different questions.
If I could take the second question first, if I may. Yes, people have thought of that and have dealt with it by way of association agreements in the past. We've had association agreements in the past with, for example, Greece, which then turned into membership. We had an association agreement, we have an association agreement with Turkey. And Turkey has applied for membership. I forgot to mention that. Its application has been put on the long finger. The other states, especially East European states, can feel almost the, can almost taste the advantage of membership as against something less than that. We have offered them a special kind of association agreement to be worked out in greater detail, to include things like environment, for example, which earlier agreements did not include. And I don't think they'll be satisfied with it, because if there's a club and if you are eligible for membership, and they are under the preamble to the treaty, once they are democratic entities, then you can't say to them, sorry, you're eligible, but you're not let in. The other guys who are in have decided against letting you in. Politically, I don't think it will stand up. As for the council-parliament nexus, the parliament is elected. It's elected by different systems in each of the member states. What I said earlier on about its lack of responsibility is the fact that the parliament is not organized by anybody. Now, we may all have great respect for democracy, the right of people to say what they think and so forth, and to govern themselves. The trouble is that if a parliament is not organized by anybody, you are not going to get consistency from it. You're not going to get good decisions from it. The parliament is not qualified to administer. It's not qualified to execute the law. It's not its job, basically. But if parliament is not controlled, I'm not using the word in a pejorative sense, I'm simply using it in the strict sense of control, then technically it's out of control. And that's too dangerous for any kind of society. If you take one difference between, say, the European scene and the American one, the president has a veto power here, which he exercised just 24 hours ago, and which he succeeded with. That doesn't exist in Europe. If you had a situation where the European Congress, call it that for simplicity, could decide something, and nobody can sort of say, well, you can't do that, I mean, it's too ridiculous. No one can oppose a veto to it. They're not required to produce a three-quarters majority or whatever it is, or two-thirds, then I think you're in serious danger. Now, the members of Parliament, of course, they are not designated by governments anymore. They were until, 10, 12 years ago, but not anymore. They're elected nowadays. As for the council changes as often as governments change. And if you have 12 governments, you're going to have one of them changing nearly every year. So yes, you're going to have a different minister, a different series of ministers, in fact, from any one country every year, and even more often than that. And one of our difficulties there, too, is this, that with 12 governments, all running on a parliamentary scale of about 4 or 5 years, you're going to have something like three general elections every year on average. And which means that ministers are going to come into a meeting and say, look, for God's sake, don't decide that today because I've got an election next week. I can't stand the pressure. And you've got this kind of thing also happens. And ministers are very accommodating towards each other on that kind of thing because they're all in the same boat, finally. They do understand when the minister says, look, I'm facing the electorate next week. Don't do it this week, please. It'll be all right the week after. Not that he can actually say that, because he mightn't be there the week after, but they always think there will be, naturally. So you have these problems. I don't think they've been very serious, quite frankly. The place has worked in spite of those difficulties. In spite of those accommodations, the council has worked well. The question is not whether the council works well or not. The difficulty is the council works in secret, in effect. Now, when I say in secret, as you said earlier on, you're going to have 50 people in the room. In fact, you'll have 100, plus 72 interpreters, because they work in 9 languages. And to have full interpretation from 9 languages into the other 8, you need 9 times 8 interpreters, 72 interpreters, for every meeting. And you need to renew them every 2 hours, because they can't take it for more than about 2 hours, which is understandable. You try simultaneous interpretation someday. So that the numbers of people in a council are phenomenal, but it does work in secret, having said that.
What would be the role of Switzerland? They want to join, and maybe want them?
Do you want to repeat the question? I can't hear it out there.
I've been asked if Switzerland would like to join, or would we want Switzerland. My answer to that may surprise you. I think Switzerland will join. I think Switzerland, which is currently one of the EFTA countries negotiating with the community, is in the process of realizing that Switzerland is going to be without any background to it, to their own constitutional views one way or the other. I mean, the notion, for example, that a European decision should go to a canton in Switzerland for confirmation isn't on. You can't run an area as big as the community on that basis. So that part of the Swiss process or constitution will have to be looked at. They'll have to find ways to take care of that.
If I may interject, the president of Switzerland within the recent months made a speech in which he said that the Swiss can't sit on a veranda on top of the Alps and watch the rest of the world go by.
That's correct. Yes. Thinking is happening on that in Switzerland, even in Switzerland, yes.
Professor Fernbach?
The United States was fortunate that in going through the debate which produced the Federalist Papers and a lot of other papers too, and nearly not approving the Constitution,
yep. Mm-hmm.
We came out of that whole episode and suddenly sanctified the Constitution.
Mm.
And it became, and is today, the centerpiece of what holds us together, despite the fact that, of course, it's changed as it has seldom been amended, as you know, but changed much by court decision and by other political and other actions in our society. The common enthusiasm for the Constitution, whatever differences we may have over what it means, is terribly important. I don't see anything comparable in the European situation. There was enthusiasm at the beginning, back to the Schuman Plan, and there was great enthusiasm at the time of the Treaty of Rome. But I, in talking with my European friends, getting places like Wilton Park and in conversations of this sort, I find it has become rather mechanical.
Mm.
And the younger generation particularly is not. It takes it for granted, it's not inspired. What can we do about that? What thought is being given to the sense of loyalty, to the sense of people's hearts being for this?
Question is, the Americans have enthusiasm for their constitution. Is there anything comparable in attitudes today among Europeans?
I would have to say that I don't think there is. I think I agree with the professor. It's, in fact, it's part of what I said, that people don't realize that what the debate is about even in Europe. They're not conscious of it. The only thought that's come up in recent times, and it's come from the Italians, is the notion of common citizenship, in the hope that that might do something. We do have a common passport already. There is a European passport. I don't have it personally, but Nora has one. And what is common about that is the color of the cover.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on your taste. It's either claret or burgundy covered, depending on which bottle you've been looking at most recently. and then the rest of it then is computer compatible, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. So that does exist. Common citizenship, I don't know. Among the young, that's where the thing has to be cured. There's no use in telling me about Europe anymore. I'm not going to get enthusiastic about anything, except, of course, golf this afternoon if the weather's good. If the young don't get into this idea of Europe, then that's going to be a great failing. But it is true that, nevertheless, having said that, everybody knows in Europe that it exists because they're all affected by it. They're affected by it in their daily work. They're affected by it in the increasing wealth of Europe is due to the European community, to the elimination of tariff barriers and barriers to trade, which is proceeding apace at an enormous speed. The variety of things you can buy in Europe nowadays, the quality of things you can buy in Europe nowadays, not only have come to equal the American qualities of 10, 15 years ago, they've gone beyond it in many respects. And this is all due to this enlarged market without barriers. If that somehow can't be channeled into persuading people that being European is a quality of being French or a quality of being German is going to be a great pity, but it could happen, I agree. In Ireland, for example, one of the places I do know best, the European community is all about agriculture, which is a great pity, because agriculture obviously is going to lose out to some degree in the gap round. It has to. The policy has its absurdities, which have to be corrected. People can't go on just paying farmers to produce stuff that nobody uses. That applies to all of us. Now, if and when that happens in Ireland, then people are going to say, well, if the agricultural advantage has gone, why are we in the bloody thing? And this is a great danger. I don't know the answer to it. It is a great danger.
Wilson Woman.
Mr. Gallagher, first an inquiry of clarification. I thought I understood you to say that to draw a distinction between the Parliament and the government in the UK. Was that correct?
I do, yes. Mm-hmm.
You
I draw a distinction, yes.
You do draw a distinction. Mm-hmm. Well, possibly a comment on that distinction after the inquiry would be very helpful. As other distinguished speakers here have referred to three elements having to do with the relation, the interface between nations. One, the ethnic problem, the nationalistic, and of course, the economic. And bearing in mind that your own government, whether it's distinction between the parliament as distinguished from the government, the rule of law in your country in the UK, if I understand it, is developed through the common law, basically human experience. And the thrust of my question would be, would you comment with that background based on experience to the extent that the operation of the United Nations has been a help or a hindrance, or to what extent has it illuminated the path of the economic community's hopes and aspirations?
Now I think I'm going to have to come back here and make another introduction on that subject, which is absolutely vast. Well, this is what you get into, of course, when you start talking about constitution making. Because constitution making is about the relationships between power and people in different ways, in various ways, between parliament and government, as an example. And I do distinguish between them. Parliament is one thing, it's there to legislate, if you like. Government is there to govern. And there are two different functions. And their relationship has to be established in some way, but they are not the same thing. That's my point. As for the building up of anything based on the United Nations, well, what is happening in the United Nations now, these days, this year, is fascinating in the sense that the five permanent members have agreed on something. And having agreed on something, they're able to persuade the Security Council as a whole to go along with them on something. And lots of people say that's a very good thing. At last the UN is now working. And I must say I hesitate. And I hesitate for two reasons. One is that the five permanent members are not representative of the real world. They represent the victors in the Second World War, and that's 50 years ago, most of 50 years ago. But they don't include any representation from Latin America or from Africa. And they don't include Japan, for example, or Germany, the two biggest economic powers after the United States in the world. So to what extent are the five now really representative? It's a query I make. I'm not saying they don't represent something. I'm just saying, what do they represent? And then secondly, and there again you come back to the whole issue of constitution making, what are the objective criteria on which they operate, if any? If there aren't any, then I don't want five powers telling me how the world should be run, because I don't know what they're going to tell me. So there again you have a query, at least, on that. To what extent, then, can the UN system influence the creation of a European community? Or to what extent do we draw a distinction between, you talk about law built up through common law, through practice, and law built up through positive law? There I would suggest that the European community is closer to the American system than it is to the United Kingdom system. And there too, I would draw your attention to a big change that has taken place in the United Kingdom, precisely because of its membership of the community, that the UK has had to take over the notion of positive law. And positive law will take over from common law, necessarily. So there is a change happening in the United Kingdom in its own system of law internally because of its membership of the European communities. To what extent the membership of the UN also changes national law? In my view, it does, in the sense that if the Security Council requires the member states of the UN to do this or that, then they are obliged to do it. That is the charter. Even if what they're required to do is not covered by their domestic law. In that sense, the UN must have an influence, yes. How big it is, very hard to say. It's only begun to operate, as you know, in that sense. Now, that's not even a partial answer to the questions you put. It's just a small attempt to get at what the question really is.
You mentioned common law and positive law as separate and distinct. Well, we don't understand your reference to positive law as a codification of experience, and if that is so, aren't they over time virtually the same in a democratic society?
I suppose you could argue that they could become so. Yes, you could argue that. That ultimately common law, which is based on experience, if you like, on cases heard and so forth, is itself a codification of something. And therefore, when sufficiently codified, does become a reference work in itself. It still is distinct from, I think, from positive law nevertheless, which requires legislation. I think the distinction remains, but it may be a distinction without very much of a difference, finally.
Victor Yonke.
Mr. Gallagher, if this Gulf situation ends up in a very untidy way, with a great deal of chaos and disorganization, will that have any effect on the European community as far as national interests or becoming the European group as a whole? Is there any internal stress there?
So far, not much, I think is the fair answer. That the stresses have not yet really begun to work to any degree. It is true that the reactions of the member states are different from each other. France and their kingdom have sent ground forces to the Middle East. No one else has done from the 12. Two or three others have sent naval forces there, usually very small. Denmark, the Foreign Minister of Denmark, was asked why they sent only one corvette to the Gulf. And he said, we've got two, we've sent half our navy. Who else has done that? So there is a difference. Others have sent nothing at all. Others, again, have sent or are prepared to contribute financially to the Gulf crisis. That no one is refusing that, by the way. Everybody has agreed to that. But the differences of approach are marked. You have to say that. It has to be admitted that they are marked. But they are in areas which are not covered by community law. that aren't covered by the European treaties. It doesn't cover defence. At least not yet. I think it will one day, but it doesn't at the minute. So the stresses have been contained by not being inside the framework. Let me put it to you that way. If the thing goes completely wrong or becomes very violent and all that, well, again, a lot depends on the result. A lot depends on how fast a result is achieved, of course. I mean, and I can't forecast that. I just don't know. But if you thought of the worst possible case, a long, drawn-out situation with no clear result, that's going to have effects far beyond the European community, I should think. It'll have global effects, that kind of situation. We will certainly suffer from it one way or another.
Bill Nolan?
By excluding the Eastern Bloc countries, aren't you going to have a very large neighbor with a second or third class economy that's going to present problems, severe problems to you down the road?
We are conscious of that. I think we are more conscious of that than America has been, because we were the first ones to say so. We said it at the Houston summit, for example, that we could not exclude the Soviet Union from some serious attention, because the effect of an implosion economically and politically of the Soviet Union would be extraordinarily severe. Far more important in my mind to us, and perhaps to the world generally, than the Gulf crisis is. Because that's you're really reaching into a population which is equivalent to, or roughly so, as that of America and or of Western Europe. And if that implodes, then we don't know what's going to happen. You could have a whole series of principalities, military governments here, and God knows what there, Bolsheviks over here, Mensheviks over there. We just don't know. But the effect of that on Europe is going to be direct and very, very grave, in my view. And it's because of that that we have said, as early as the Houston summit, we cannot simply leave Russia out of our consideration in terms of assisting them to deal with these problems they've got. Now, at the same time, we've conducted a study on this, which will be published around about the middle of this month. And IMF is making a study which will be finished by the end of this month. They're slightly different studies on the situation in the Soviet Union. And all the information that I have at the minute from the preliminary studies is that the situation is near chaos economically in the Soviet Union. There may be exaggeration there. The harvest may be better than people have estimated to date. It looks like the figures are getting better rather than worse. There's been some change there, and that's important. But if, as the information we have at present suggests, that the Soviet Union is in such a condition that it could not administer funds sent in from outside, then don't send them. That's not the way of dealing with it. There must be other ways of dealing with the problem. Like, for example, simply training people to deal with the market economy.
Louise?
Do you think that the European Union will be able to do anything to help stop the fighting in Northern Ireland?
Indirectly, yes. Indirectly in the sense that we all belong to the same community. There are no tariff barriers between us anymore. There are no trade barriers, or there won't be by the end of next year, end of 1992, between us anymore. And if people would simply draw back from shooting each other long enough just to think about things, I think they could find a way of agreeing to disagree and get on with living. In that sense, the European community indirectly could have a very important effect. But not directly. It doesn't get involved in that directly. It's got enough on its hands without that.
Bill Wimple?
Do you think it's likely that the growth and development and expansion of the community and its relationships, powers, and so on will lead a proliferation of lawyers and lawsuits to adjudicate these things in the courts as I think it's fair to say has happened in this country?
I'm trying to count the House and see whether there's a majority of lawyers or not. I don't think it will happen in quite that way, no, because European courts in many cases, and the UK courts in particular, followed by the Irish courts, judges have a habit of throwing out lawyers who are insistent on points that have no real effect on the case, and they simply refuse to listen to them. And this has stopped the numbers of lawyers in Ireland from increasing from a third of the population to three-thirds of it.
You know the traditional definition of sovereignty, it's supreme law enforcing and law-making power within a state. Oftentimes, as in our own case, that issue has been settled in conflict and war. What if there were ever a dispute, even if some of the trends you have indicated should fully materialize, a dispute leading to war? What capacity does the European community have to resolve any issues of that kind?
I suppose the answer really is that our experience is different from the American experience. It even starts from a different basis. In other words, we had been through it all before we began to develop a relationship of an organic kind among ourselves. And one of the reasons why we're doing it is because we've been through so many wars. The Second World War, the First World War, these are, in European terms, civil wars, basically. Wars pitting Germany against France, against the United Kingdom, and so on. 1870, a civil war, Germany-France, basically. And after a series of these things, enough wise men like Schumann, like Monet, said, this can't go on. So we start on that basis, that we're not going to fight any more wars. That is not in our interest. The American Constitution, fabulous though it be, did actually contain the seeds of the Civil War when you examine it, because it did not answer fully, or at least not satisfactorily, the question of the division between state powers and federal powers. And I read a lot of that history when I was a young fellow. I read a great deal of the argument leading up to the American Civil War, and an awful lot of it is couched in terms of states' rights and not in terms of slavery, which is very interesting for an outsider to discover. And in that sense, you didn't have the experience to run a constitution without getting into that problem, finally, as happened. I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying historically that's what happened. Europe has been through its civil wars and now is creating a constitution, taking into account that we've been through it, we've had enough of it, no more of it. So there's no situation envisageable in which there will be any armed conflict because of something decided in Brussels by the Council of Ministers. It's not going to happen. There's no quarrel there which has the depth of the quarrel that subsisted in America even after the Constitution was created. And let's not forget in Mr. Jefferson's university that he himself saw to it that the fact that he was President of the United States was never put in his tombstone.
Mr. Ambassador, the reason you're here is that you so inspired a group of people with whom you met earlier that they said under any circumstance the Miller Center ought to be sure to bring you back. Now that we brought you back and confirmed their initial judgment, we very much hope, whether on the UN subject or any other subject, that you'd return and talk to our group again. Maybe that's the fullest evidence of how successful you've been. Thank you very much.